Chapter 9. I was a sailor too. Falk thought that a sail, or would be able to understand certain things best. He talked, as if the Hermans had been living all their life in a rural hamlet, and I alone had been capable, with my practice in life, of a large and indulgent view of certain occurrences. That was what my diplomacy was leading me to. I began suddenly to dislike it. I say, Falk, I asked quite brusquely, you haven't already a wife put away somewhere? The pain and disgust of his denial were very striking. Couldn't I understand that he was as respectable as any white man hereabouts, earning his living honestly? He was suffering from my suspicion, and the low undertone of his voice made his protestation sound very pathetic. For a moment he shamed me, but, my diplomacy notwithstanding, I seemed to develop a conscience, as if in very truth it were in my power, to decide the success of this matrimonial enterprise. By pretending hard enough we come to believe anything to our advantage. And I had been pretending very hard, because I meant yet to be towed safely down the river. But through conscience or stupidity, I couldn't help alluding to the Vanlo affair. You acted rather badly there. Didn't you? Was what I ventured actually, to say for the logic of our conduct, is always at the mercy of obscure and unforeseen impulses. His dilated pupils swerved from my face, glancing at the window with a sort of scared fury. We heard behind the blinds the continuous and sudden clicking of ivory, a jovial murmur of many voices, and Schomburg's deep manly laugh. That confounded old woman of a hotel keeper then would never let it rest. Falk exclaimed. L, yes. It had happened 2 years ago. When it came to the point he owned he couldn't make up his mind, to trust Fred Vanlo no sailor, a bit of a fool too. He could not trust him, but, to stop his row, he had lent him enough money to pay all his debts before he left. I was greatly surprised to hear this. Then Falk could not be such a miser after all. So much the better for the girl. For a time he sat silent, then he picked up a card, and while looking at it he said, "You need not think of anything bad. It was an accident. I've been unfortunate once. Then in heaven's name say nothing about it." As soon as these words were out of my mouth I fancied I had said something immoral. He shook his head negatively. It had to be told. He considered it proper that the relations of the lady should know. No doubt I thought to myself had Miss Vanlo not been 30, and damaged by the climate he would have found it possible to entrust Fred Vanlo with this confidence. And then the figure of Herman's niece appeared before my mind's eye, with the wealth of her opulent form, her rich youth, her lavish strength. With that powerful and immaculate vitality, her girlish form must have shouted aloud of life to that man, whereas poor Miss Vanlo could only sing sentimental songs to the strumming of a piano. "And that Herman hates me, I know it," he cried in his undertone, with a sudden recrudescence of anxiety. "Must tell him. It is proper that they should know. You would say so yourself." He then murmured an utterly mysterious allusion to the necessity for peculiar domestic arrangements. Though my curiosity was excited, I did not want to hear any of his confidences. I feared he might give me a piece of information that would make my assumed role of matchmaker odious, however unreal it was. I was aware that he could have the girl for the asking. And keeping down the desire to laugh in his face, I expressed a confident belief in my ability to argue away Herman's dislike for him. "I'm sure I can make it all right," I said. He looked very pleased. And when we rose, not a word had been said about towage. Not a word. The game was won, and the honor was safe. Oh, blessed white cotton umbrella. We shook hands, and I was holding myself with difficulty from breaking into a step dance of joy when he came back, striding all the length of the veranda, and said doubtfully, "I say, Captain, I have your word? You won't turn round?" Heavens! The fright he gave me. Behind his tone of doubt there was something desperate and menacing. The infatuated ass. but I was equal to the situation. My dear Fogg, I said, beginning to lie with a glibness and effrontery that amazed me even at the time, confidence for confidence. He had made no confidences. Will tell you that I am already engaged to an extremely charming girl at home, and so you understand. He caught my hand and wrung it in a crushing grip. Pardon me. I feel it every day more difficult to live alone. On rice and fish, I interrupted smartly, giggling with the sheer nervousness of a danger escaped. He dropped my hand, as if it had become suddenly red hot. A moment of profound silence ensued, as though something extraordinary had happened. I promise you to obtain Herman's consent, I faltered out at last, and it seemed to me that he could not help seeing through that humbugging promise. If there's anything else to get over, I shall endeavor to stand by you, I conceded further, feeling somehow defeated and overborne. But you must do your best yourself. I have been unfortunate once, he muttered unemotionally, and turning his back on me he went away, thumping slowly the plank floor, as if his feet had been shod with iron. Next morning, however, he was lively enough as man-boat, a combination of splashing and shouting, of the insolent commotion below with the steady overbearing glare of the silent headpiece above. He turned us out most unnecessarily at an ungodly hour, but it was nearly 11 in the morning before he brought me up a cable's length from Herman's ship. And he did it very badly too, in a hurry, and nearly contriving to miss altogether the patch of good holding ground, because, forsooth, he had caught sight of Herman's niece on the poop. And so did I, and probably as soon as he had seen her himself. I saw the modest, sleek glory of the tawny head, and the full, gray shape of the girlish print frock she filled so perfectly, so satisfactorily, with the seduction of unfaltering curves a very nymph of Diana the Huntress. And Diana the ship sat, high-walled and as solid as an institution, on the smooth level of the water, the most uninspiring and respectable craft upon the seas, useful and ugly, devoted to the support of domestic virtues like any grocer's shop on shore. At once Fox steamed away, for there was some work for him to do. He would return in the evening. He ranged close by us, passing out dead slow, without a hail. The beat of the paddle wheels reverberating amongst the stony islets, as if from the ruined walls of a vast arena, filled the anchorage confusedly with the clapping sounds of a mighty and leisurely applause. Abreast of Herman's ship he stopped the engines, and a profound silence reigned over the rocks, the shore and the sea, for the time it took him to raise his hat aloft before the nymph of the gray print frock. I had snatched up my binoculars, and I can answer for it, she didn't stir a limb, standing by the rail shapely and erect, with one of her hands grasping a rope at the height of her head, while the way of the tug carried slowly past her the lingering and profound homage of the man. There was for me an enormous significance in the scene, the sense of having witnessed a solemn declaration. The die was cast. After such a manifestation he couldn't back out. And I reflected that it was nothing whatever to me now. With a rush of black smoke belching suddenly out of the funnel, and a mad swirl of paddle wheels provoking a burst of weird and precipitated clapping, the tug shot out of the desolate arena. The rocky islets lay on the sea like the heaps of a cyclopean ruin on a plain. The centipedes and scorpions lurked under the stones. There was not a single blade of grass in sight anywhere, not a single lizard sunning himself on a boulder by the shore. When I looked again at Herman's ship, the girl had disappeared. I could not detect the smallest dot of a bird on the immense sky, and the flatness of the land continued the flatness of the sea to the naked line of the horizon. This is the setting now inseparably connected with my knowledge of Fox's misfortune. My diplomacy had brought me there, and now I had only to wait the time for taking up the role of an ambassador. My diplomacy was a success. My ship was safe. Old Gambrel would probably live. A feeble sound of a tapping hammer came intermittently from the Diana. During the afternoon I looked at times at the old homely ship, the faithful nurse of Hermann's progeny, or yawned towards the distant temple of Buddha, like a lonely hillock on the plain, where shaven priests cherish the thoughts of that annihilation which is the worthier ward of us all. Unfortunate. He had been unfortunate once. Well, that was not so bad as life goes. And what the devil could be the nature of that misfortune? I remembered that I had known a man before who had declared himself to have fallen, years ago, a victim to misfortune. But this misfortune, whose effects appeared permanent, he looked desperately hard up, when considered dispassionately, seemed indistinguishable from a breach of trust. Could it be something of that nature? Apart, however, from the utter improbability that he would offer to talk of it even to his future uncle-in-law, I had a strange feeling that Fox's physique unfitted him for that sort of delinquency. As the person of Hermann's niece exhaled the profound physical charm of feminine form, so her adorer's big frame embodied to my senses the hard straight masculinity that would conceivably kill, but would not condescend to cheat. The thing was obvious. I might just as well have suspected the girl of a curvature of the spine. And I perceived that the sun was about to set. The smoke of Fox Tug hove in sight, far away at the mouth of the river. It was time for me to assume the character of an ambassador, and the negotiation would not be difficult except in the matter of keeping my countenance. It was all too extravagantly nonsensical, and I conceived that it would be best to compose for myself a grave demeanor. I practiced this in my boat as I went along, but the bashfulness that came secretly upon me the moment I stepped on the deck of the Diana is inexplicable. As soon as we had exchanged greetings, Hermann asked me eagerly if I knew whether Falk had found his white parasol. He's going to bring it to you himself directly, I said with great solemnity. In time I am charged with an important message for which he begs your favorable consideration. He is in love with your niece. He hissed with an animosity that made my assumed gravity change into the most genuine concern. What meant this tone? And I hurried on. He wishes, with your consent of course, to ask her to marry him at once before you leave here, that is. He would speak to the consul. Hermann sat down and smoked violently. 5 minutes passed in that furious meditation, and then, taking the long pipe out of his mouth, he burst into a hot diatribe against Falk, against his cupidity, his stupidity, a fellow that can hardly be got to say S or O to the simplest question, against his outrageous treatment of the shipping in port because he saw they were at his mercy, and against his manner of walking, which to his, Hermann's, mind showed a conceit positively unbearable. The damage to the old Diana was not forgotten, of course, and there was nothing of any nature said or done by Falk even to the last offer of refreshment in the hotel that did not seem to have been a cause of offense. Had the cheek to drag him, Hermann, into that coffee room, as though a drink from him could make up for $47.50 of damage in the cost of wood alone, not counting 2 days' work for the carpenter. Of course he would not stand in the girl's way. He was going home to Germany. There were plenty of poor girls walking about in Germany. He's very much in love, was all I found to say. Yes, he cried. And it is time to, after Macking himself and me talked about ashore the last voyage I was here, and then now again, coming on board every evening unsettling the girl's mind, and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.